like that.
Hello, hello, hello. I could do that all day, Liam.
I want to make a documentary film. This is my idea. Don't steal it. But I want to make a documentary film where it's just 200 people in front of the camera saying what they had for breakfast. Because you know that's always the warm-up question. And that's it. The film never begins. It's just 200 false starts.
I would love that.
Yeah, right? I would watch that. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I took a breakfast break from work today. I think that people frequently take a lunch, and I decided to innovate by taking a breakfast break.
That's a good idea.
It went well.
What did you have for breakfast?
Well, I had two eggs over easy. I had wheat toast, and Moe's Diner up there makes the world's best home fried potatoes.
See, now I just need 199 more, and I have one.
You're all set.
There you go.
Anyhow, hello, friends.
Hi,
listeners. To the podcast, which this is, nominally. This is Let's Make Mistakes, a podcast that is sort of a little bit about design and the web and things like that. And today, dear listeners, my goodness, dear listeners, we have Cara Platoni, which rhymes with...
Scarabad Pony.
Correct.
Unfortunately.
Or fortunately, because that's an easy mnemonic.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are other rhymes, but I like that one a lot.
It really fits in with Mule, too.
Oh, that's true.
That's true. There's an ungulate. There's some sort of psychological stress.
Right.
All of those things, I think, are...
very, very on brand.
Super on brand. Yeah. We have Cara Platoni here. She is an interesting person in several ways. We did a small amount of research.
Just enough, though.
Just enough research.
Just enough to be dangerous, right?
Exactly. However, given that we have done only a little bit of research and she has spent presumably her entire life researching herself, as we all do, dear listeners, I would like her to introduce herself and tell us a little bit about what she does.
Okay, sure. No, actually, I just threw myself into Google this morning and really quickly did a top-level search. I'm okay.
You skimmed?
I just looked at the top headlines. I'm a science reporter, and I teach at UC Berkeley in the Graduate School of Journalism. And so I've been here in the Bay Area, home of Mule, for all of my career. As a reporter, I used to write for the East Bay Express, which is an alt-weekly, and I've been a science reporter for most of my career. So the reason I'm here today is because I wrote a book, kind of a weird book, but a book that I think is a lot of fun. That's about hacking perception and hacking the senses. I think that's what we're going to talk about, is some of the like weird ways you can hack your version of reality.
I read the introduction because I picked up an advanced PDF this morning, and it's achingly interesting, and I immediately actually ponied up the money to put it on my phone, which is where I typically read things.
You are too kind. Were you impressed that it starts in a Radio Shack?
I loved that. My local Radio Shack just closed, and it makes me really sad because a lot of possibilities are closed off to me.
Yeah, I have to say, as a science writer, you're always worried that things are going to outdate before you can get them to the page. And I was really, really worried that Radio Shack was going to go out of business and the whole book would just be outdated from page one. But it starts in a Radio Shack because one of the groups that I got to hang out with when I was writing this book is a group called Grindhouse Wetware. And they're a biohacker collective from Pittsburgh. And they are trying to figure out basically a way to hack their bodies to give themselves a new sense. So when we were in that Radio Shack, Tim Cannon, who's one of the leaders of Grindhouse, had just gotten implanted with this device that's it was in his left arm. It's about the size of a deck of cards. So it's, you know, pretty hefty. And it basically read his temperature out to his phone, ported his temperature to his phone. And he could charge it with a battery charging coil. And when he did, it would flash. It would light up red and green in response to it. But that wasn't really the thing they wanted to build. That was the tester. That was the demo to see if Tim would die, right?
Oh, God.
It was big. And they were worried, you know, that his immune system would reject it, or that the battery would breach, or, you know, it would leach something horrible into his bloodstream. So it was the tester to see if he could safely wear this giant implanted device for a while. So he wore it for 3 months, and then it started to expand because of the heat of the charging coil. Yeah, so they took it out. So that one only lasted 3 months. But what they were there to buy parts for was they had this idea of building an in-hand compass. So the idea is a lot of the biohackers I met are motivated by the sense that the standard issue human body kind of sucks. right? They're like, yeah, it's not so great. No competent engineer would design it. It gets old, it dies. As Tim once told me, you know, he wished his lifespan could be decoupled from his bacon intake. And they had a lot of other things where they said, you know, look, other animals can do cool things that we can't do. Like, so humans can only see the visible spectrum of light, but we know there are snakes that can sense infrared. We know that honeybees can see the ultraviolet. We know that a lot of animals can sense electromagnetic fields, right? So this is how birds migrate and fish and sea turtles and a lot of these animals do it. So they were like, we're gonna build ourselves a shortcut. We're going to build ourselves a hack to give ourselves a sense of direction. So they came up with this idea for an in-hand compass. Go on the back of your hand, about the size of a quarter, and it would light up whenever you're within 5 degrees of north. That was what they were going to do.
Oh, okay.
So that's the beginning of my book. So, you know, it's like pretty much your typical book.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think also the book really powerfully recasts hacking. In other contexts, hacking is this negative connotation that it's like invading or a security risk, and perhaps because a domain is their own bodies. And I think that you do a great job also of making, you know, I'm not a step away from like implanting something into my body, but there are different ways that I wasn't really aware of that I do biohack.
Yeah. This is so fascinating, right? And this is not just biohacking, but any kind of hacking. The stereotype is that it's bad.
Right.
Is that somebody's going to get into your computer and steal your credit card information or, I don't know, whatever it is, right? But hacking has been this kind of a cool subversive thing that is a part of a lot of maker cultures. In fact, last night I just got the chance to meet and interview Dale Doherty, who's the founder of Make Magazine and the Maker Faire.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and he has a new book called Free to Make that just came out. And he kind of like tracks making back to punk rock, saying like, these are the makers of music, you know, people who had been left out of the music mainstream, who are like, we're going to do it ourselves.
Right.
We're going to make things in our own cheap way, and we don't care what your industry standards are. And of course, in software, there's this whole, you know, hacker movement. And then with products, with physical objects, now we have this wave of people who say, like, basically, if you can't open it, you don't own it. That's one of the, that's kind of like a hacker or maker ethic. Like, if you can't mod it, if it's sealed when it comes out of the box, then it's not yours. It's the company made it and you can't make it yours.
Right.
And which is a really cool argument. And so biohackers take this argument and then they transpose it onto the body and they say it's mine and I should be able to do whatever I want with it.
Right.
And that's a fascinating argument, because this whole idea about who owns your body and what you can do with it, it has all of these, like, it has a religious dimension and a political dimension. And what people can do with their bodies has ended up in court, right? The whole issue of abortion is part of the right to privacy, the right that a woman can choose what she wants to do with her medical treatment. The courts have ruled that your hair color is protected under freedom of expression. They have ruled that tattoos are protected as free speech. So biohackers are saying, okay, let's take it a step further. Now, there are a lot of people who say this is really dumb and you're going to die, right? Like, that's the other argument.
For instance, I had a housemate. I think that this is one of the most powerful things about MIT is, and I did my undergrad there, is taking away the just opening hacking to the entire undergrad community and having it. So there's just like lots of crazy shit that happens on campus all the time with people putting stuff on top of the dome or people exploring different areas of the building infrastructure, or and that's kind of encouraged. There's a whole hacking community that, irrespective of where you live or even what your major is, like, people become a part of. And it really does like hold campus together in a way. And there's a whole community, the MITRES, where they're kind of building tall bikes, and it's this student-run electronics shop, which I kind of imagined the Radio Shack in your book is serving similar purposes too. It just kind of takes hacking out of the context of being this dangerous, negative thing, and more, well, if the barrier to entry is just like anyone, then it allows for more creativity. That hacking is positive because you don't have to go through the normal channels. Mm-hmm. You can take the skills, the engineering skills that you have, and apply it to whatever domain.
Yeah, a lot of the people that I talked to said, okay, the reason that I hack is because nobody's going to build what I want them to build because it's not profitable. There's not enough demand. You know, I don't have a recognized medical need. So industry isn't going to build it for me. My doctor's not going to give it to me. And the people that I talked to in my book, there was this big divide between people who were doing things, creative projects on their own, out of a sense of curiosity or out of a sense of frustration about their own limits. And then people on kind of the corporate research side or the university research side who are doing, I think, what we can call biohacking to develop assistive technologies for people with medical needs. And not just any medical needs, but, you know, large populations of medical needs. So let me give you an example from the other side. So one of the things that I did, or I got to do, is hang out with a guy named Dean, who is one of the first people to ever have a retinal implant in his eye. Wow. And he's such an interesting guy because Dean was born with normal vision. He lost it as an adult. He was essentially blind for 17 years. He could kind of perceive light if you shone a light directly in his eye, but that's it. And then he volunteered for a clinical trial for a device called the Argus 2, which is the first retinal implant to go on sale in the United States. So this is a chip that actually lives inside his eye. It's tacked to the back of the interior of his eyeball.
Wait, did you say tacked?
Yeah, it's tacked with an actual tack. I watched the videotape from the surgery for this, so I actually can tell you it's tacked.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
All right.
So here's the way it works. So retinitis pigmentosa, the disease he has, basically kills a lot of the cells in your eye, in your retina, but not all of them. There are still a few that are left. So the idea is, okay, we need a device that can electrically stimulate those remaining cells and give him some perception of sight. So he wears this special pair of glasses, and over the bridge of his nose, there's this little camera. And the camera takes images from the real world, sends them to this video processor unit that he carries in his pocket. The video processor unit converts those images. And by the way, it does cool things that your eye and my mind can't. Like it can flip black and white, which can make it easier for him to find doors and windows. And it can sharpen lines, which helps him tell when there's a man-made thing in his environment instead of kind of background ambient noise.
Huh.
So it does all this cool like video processing, right? And then it sends it up to this implant in his eye, and the actual part of the electrode that's in his eye has 60 little electrodes that fire and stimulate the cells in his eyes. It's kind of like having 60 pixel vision. But the image that he gets in his brain, the perceptual experience he has in his brain, isn't what he remembers sight being like. And that's one of the things that's so cool about him, is that he remembers what the world looked like when he had vision. So he remembers color, and he remembers what three-dimensional objects are like, and he knows he doesn't have that anymore. Instead, the way the world looks to him is it's just flashes of light that indicate contrast points between things that are really dark and really light. So like when we were walking down the street, he would see kind of the place where the white sidewalk and the black asphalt merged as just a series of flashing points, which isn't a lot of information, but it's enough for him to get around. He can get off the bus and walk to work doing that. One day when he was looking at me, I'm organic material, so I didn't look like anything to him most of the time. But one day he said to me, "Your eyes are glowing." And I said, "What does that mean?" And we realized I was wearing my glasses and he was just seeing the reflection off my glasses. So he has vision, but it's not vision the way you and I might think of it. What's so cool about that is it shows you that vision is a construct. Your brain is just creating a reality for you based on how much information you have.
Or need, right?
And so we have a lot of information because we have a lot of working cells in our eyes. He only has like 52 pixel vision because some of his electrodes aren't working. So he has very sparse information, but his brain still can make a pattern out of the chaos, which is really cool. And when I was talking with the people at the company who make this, I was saying like, well, you know, like, couldn't you actually give him superpowers in some ways? And they were saying, yeah, like, why does the camera have to be something he's wearing on his face? Couldn't we hook up his eye to any camera anywhere in the world, like somebody's webcam somewhere else? Shouldn't he be able to have true television, the ability to see at a distance anywhere in the world? And they said, there's no reason we couldn't hook it up to like a heat sensing camera and give him night vision. Hmm. And then he would arguably have better vision in the dark than anybody else does.
Right. Yeah.
And I was saying, does it have a rewind button? Like, can he go back in time and have total recall? And they said, that's interesting. So, so we have to wait for version two. But so that's an example of a company that is doing something to be assistive. They're trying to help somebody who has a medical problem that can't be cured any other way. And they're trying to do it for a really big group. There are a lot of people who have retinitis pigmentosa. There's a lot of people who have advanced macular degeneration, which is the next disease that they're going to work on. But there aren't a lot of people who have, you know, any need for an in-hand compass or sure. an in-hand thermometer. So a lot of people who want to build these things are saying like, no one's going to build it. Got to do it myself. Mm-hmm. There was an interesting guy that I met, this guy, Rich Lee.
Or they're frustrated with the rate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like, Apple's not going to do it. It's going to take them forever.
Yeah. I had this housemate who had an eye pancreas.
Whoa.
To give him insulin. He was like one of the first people to get this. And he was really frustrated because apparently, so he had like two monitors and then one of them kind of would collect his blood sugar constantly. And he was a hacker. So he hacked a little device to do it. But apparently that's illegal. So to get your own data from a medical device that's on you is illegal.
It's so interesting, right? And so, you know, one of the things people would bring up is like, your doctor can't do this for you because you know, your doctor takes the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm, first of all, right?
And this is introducing harm.
Right, exactly. Or at least has the potential to. And then, of course, like your insurance won't cover it, so it's going to be very expensive, whatever it is. One of the best critiques of some of this wearable technology and implantable technology I got came from a disability scholar from the University of Calgary. This guy, his name is Gregor Wolbring, really smart guy. And he said, anytime you think about bringing technology onto the body or into the body, you kind of have to think about how it changes our expectations for what a body should be able to do and what it means to be productive and normal in our society. So he said, think about how the telephone changed what a person was expected to do. And this is, you know, just something that's a few generations old. So he said, think about what it did to all the people who relied on lip reading, who could no longer do it. Or he said, think about the computer. Now we expect everybody to be able to look at a screen, type, you know, manipulate a mouse, all of these things. And you have to do it if you want an education, if you want a middle-class job. He said, even something as simple as a job delivering pizzas requires your ability to drive a car. So when we start talking about, you know, devices that would add sensors to the body or require people to wear, you know, some kind of augmented reality spectacle or something like that, we have to think about who's going to be able to comfortably do it and what happens for the people who are left out. So I said, you could, if you wanted to, not use computers, but it's going to affect your social standing. It's going to affect your economic life. It's going to affect your friendships, your job. And he said, is that really a choice?
Right.
And I thought, well, that's really a smart critique because one of the things that drives not just biohacking, but all of this augmentive technology, all of this idea of wearables and optimizing yourself and tracking your body metrics is that it's going to make us better. Well, what is better? You know, better for who, right? These are cool questions to ask.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I've blown your mind.
Yeah, actually, kind of a lot.
It is a lot. Okay, well, let me think of another interesting kind of hack that I saw people doing. So I want to say, a lot of people think like, oh, this is about electronics and gadgets and like those things are very interesting and cool. And when I do talks, everybody wants to see the pictures because why not, right? Mm-hmm. But one of the coolest hacks that I got to see does not involve technology that lights up. It involves chemistry. And I think we have a lot of technologies in our lives that we've forgotten our technologies because they seem very obvious and chemistry and medicine are among them, right? So I went to a hospital in France to meet a group of women who are mostly women who work in or have retired from the cosmetics industry. So a lot of perfumers and retired perfumers. And what they were doing is going to the geriatrics ward at a hospital, and they were using scents to help people with Alzheimer's disease recall memories. Because isn't that amazing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, your face just did the thing that everybody's face does when I say this. Everybody goes like, oh, yeah, that's right. Because like smell is super evocative.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And smell is super evocative because the smell part of your brain is actually kind of it's your oldest sense. It's the oldest part of the brain. Like way, way back in amoeboid days, they basically had what was called a chemical sense, which was a way that they could pick up chemicals and say like, oh, is that food? I should go over there. Or mm-hmm. is that like something I should mate with? I should go over there. Or, oh, it's poisonous. I'll get away. What cognitive scientists call go, no-go information. And then sense of smell and taste developed around this. And it's a super old part of your brain that basically all of the centers for emotion and memory are right on top of, and they're very, very closely connected. So that's why, like, when you walk into your childhood school or when you walk into your grandparents' house or when you smell, like, the scent of tobacco smoke that somebody, you know, used to smoke or perfume or something like that, it just brings it all back to you, right? So they had this idea, which is, okay, so people who have Alzheimer's often can't communicate very well. They don't remember words. They don't remember who people are. They can't remember and follow stories. So what if we just bring in scents and then they free associate about what the scent is? And these sweet ladies would not consider themselves biohackers, but that is a hack, right? I mean, that's your definition of a hack.
Right. Which is broader.
Yeah. It's like a clever way around a problem. So what they would do is, the day I was there, they were doing scents of fruits, and they had these little glass vials, and they had like this little paper strips that you get at the perfume counter when they want to test a perfume. And so they dip it in like the scent of lemon or something like that, and they would wave it under somebody's nose, and they say like, Madame, what do you smell? And they would see if they could get her to talk. And it was just a beautiful idea. And then the thing that really blew my mind is all of the, they had, they called it a bibliothèque, a library of scents, and they were all French. You know, so it's like bread and wine and all of these fruits, all of these outdoor smells. They had things that just like would be significant to a French person, but maybe not to somebody who was raised somewhere else. So like they had the smell of king cake, which is like you eat mm-hmm. it at the holiday of Epiphany. And they had all of these kind of like outdoor smells of mushrooms and berries, because a lot of people have positive memories of kind of going on rambles in the woods. And those are like woodsy smells. They had the smell of vetiver, which is used in men's cologne a lot. And they told me that once they gave it to this old man who had been totally silent, like the whole time they were working with him. And then they gave him the scent of vetiver, and he said, ah, how many girls I seduced with vetiver. So cute. And they had bad smells too, or smells that were meant to be kind of evocative. They gave the smell of asphalt to not a geriatric patient, but a young man who had come out of a coma after being in a motorcycle accident. And the first things he said were moto and dead, because they're saying like memories aren't necessarily happy. So anyway, so they had this bibliothèque of French scents. And then through amazing luck, I learned about a similar project that was being done in Singapore. And in Singapore, there's kind of a lot of different ethnic communities that live there all together, including people who are of Chinese descent and Indian descent and European descent. And so they had created a totally different smell library, because the smells that work in Singapore are different than the smells that would work in France, or different than the smells that would work in the United States. So in Singapore, they had this amazing one. They'd created the smell of opium for a generation that remembers smoking opium. They had the scent of New Year's firecrackers. They had tamarind. They had curry. They had the smell of the seashore. And what that taught me was the way you learn to recognize a smell is totally culturally driven. It has to do with the words you learn, the language you speak, the things you grew up eating, the things that have been in your environment. So what they smelled and what I smelled were totally different.
Far out.
It's really wild.
The New York version of this would be like urine, factory steam, pizza. Bagels.
Wait, can I take this in a metatextual direction?
Yes.
You've talked about going to France
yes.
for this. Did you spend any time in Singapore?
No, I wish. I really wanted to go.
But you were in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I was in lovely Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
How long did this take you, and where did you go to put this research together?
This was actually really fast by book standards. I had essentially 15 months start to finish for the whole thing, including the proposal. Mm-hmm. So it was like proposal, send it in, get it accepted. And then I really had, after that, only 11 months to run around the world. So I went to 8 U.S. states, 4 countries, if you count the United States, I guess 3 other countries. Mm-hmm. And the way I did it was I basically sofa surfed. So I would put something on Facebook and say like, hey guys, I got to go to Toronto to meet a guy who built a camera into his eye socket. Does anyone have a couch today? Right? Let's see, where else? Pittsburgh, Toronto, Paris, London. I went to London. I went to Montreal. I went to a military base in Denver. There was a really cool experiment going on to see whether you could use virtual reality to prevent soldiers from getting PTSD. So I was like, can I crash on somebody's couch? And amazingly, people said yes. Journalists are really sympathetic to anybody who is doing things on a $0 budget. And they'll be like, sure.
As we well know from working with journalists here.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was not just journalists too, but it was a lot of them. So everyone was like, yeah, sure. Stay on my couch. Stay on my air mattress. Stay on my bathtub, whatever it is. I had 2 people say, I'm not even going to be home. 2 people I did not know. Say, I'm not even going to be home, but I'll just hide a key for you. Go stay in my house.
Oh.
Yeah. And in one case, they hadn't even moved in yet. It was just like an air mattress and a box in their empty house.
I believe that's referred to as an Airbnb.
Yeah. Yeah. That's in Bay Area speak.
Yeah. So that's how I did it. There's more than 100 interviews in this book, which is a lot.
Yeah.
I was a beginner when I started this. I had done a little bit of reporting in related areas, but not much. So I really went in just kind of being like, teach me, people. And people are extraordinarily generous with their time and with their knowledge and with wanting to explain what they're doing. These people were doing really cool stuff. And one of the things that started to happen is I'd go talk to the biohackers or, you know, somebody who's building a cool, weird thing. Then I'd go talk to the local neuroscientist or whoever was working on this in the lab. And they totally were not talking to one another.
Oh.
They didn't know what the other one was doing. And the neuroscientist would be like, oh, yeah, this is sound in principle, but the way they're doing it is like slow and the object is clunky and there's a faster, better way to do this. And then the biohackers would say like, yeah, but you won't do it. You have to go through clinical review. You have to get, you know, permission from your campus. You have ethics guidelines about human experimentation. This will,
ethics always gets in the way.
Yeah, this will cost you a lot of money if you do it. We're just going to do it in the basement. And it was cool. I really felt like the plague rat that was taking ideas from one group to the next.
Ideological plague rat.
Yeah.
So it sounds like these communities are kind of like complementary.
Yeah, it was interesting. And I got some feedback from people saying, I wish we could work together more. You know, on the scientist side or the medical side or the research side, they do have a lot of serious constraints. They have, you know, not only ethics guidelines and human experimentation limitations, but, you know, they always have to get grants. They're up for tenure review. They have to be very careful about what they do and where they put their research time and money. And I think saying I'm going to build a Gaia compass for his hand is probably not a tenurable project for the most part.
Perhaps not.
But I did hear, like, I spent some time talking with Sampa von Cyborg, who is a body modder, a very prestigious body modder. He's been at it for a long time, more than 2 decades.
Last name von Cyborg?
Von Cyborg. Sampa von Cyborg.
Of the von Cyborgs.
Of the von Cyborgs.
Sure.
He's Finnish but he lives in the UK, and he is one of the leaders in implanting magnets in people's hands, which is kind of like it's like the gateway hack. It's kind of like, you know, people, Tim Cannon called it your blood sacrifice to the grinder gods. It's just like the first hack you have to try because it's quite small. So the idea is, and there are different designs for it. But the idea is it's a small magnet that's encased in silicone or some kind of protective casing. And people usually get it in their fingertips, or people get it sometimes in the base of their hand. I've seen it go into kind of like the divot between your thumb and your forefinger. And people do it kind of as a bid to see if you can pick up magnetic information about your environment.
Whoa.
Yeah, right?
Like, so, if you can form the perception around that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Exactly. So you have this magnet in your hand. Can you start sensing anything based on it?
And can you hunt better? Can you?
So I talked to lots of people who had these magnet implants, and I say, what does it do for you? And a lot of people would say, okay, well, first of all, like, I can pick up things with my hand now, and that's cool. Like, I can pick up bottle caps or whatever. People would say, I can feel metal. You know, I can feel wire in the wall. I can feel the staple in this paper. But kind of the biggest claim that they were making is that they could feel electric current. They would say, I can feel when my hard drive spools up. I can feel when I'm standing next to the refrigerator. I can feel when the microwave is on. And so now the big question that I have to ask as the science reporter is, what's really happening, right? Is this true magnetic sense the way a bird or a sea turtle does, which, by the way, is for them to sense direction, you know, so that they can migrate, right? It's not quite the same thing as feeling a refrigerator, right? Or is it something else? So then I had to go to all the neuroscientists and say, what's going on? And they said, what? People are putting magnets in their hands, right? So this is me being the plague rat. The consensus people came to is that probably what is happening is that the magnet moves in response to the energy in its environment. So it's vibrating. And then the touch sensors, which you already have in your skin, in your hand, are picking up on that motion. And they're carrying that information to the brain. So basically the magnet is vibrating and you're picking up on the vibration. And so is that true electromagnetic sense? Well, not in the same way a sea turtle has it. But a scientist told me, well, it's kind of like a Geiger counter. Like, a Geiger counter picks up on radiation. You can't sense it otherwise, but it gives you a sound signal when there's radiation in your environment. Or they said it's like the way blind people use Braille. They're using touch as a replacement for sight. So it's a way that your brain takes in new information from the environment and processes it in a meaningful way. And this is actually the scientific term for it is sensory substitution. Basically, you use one sense to substitute for another. So here, you're getting some information about your environment and you're processing it through a channel you already have, which is touch.
Right.
Right.
Okay, whereas animals have like another channel that they're able to connect with the information.
Yeah, we think. But okay, here's the weird thing. Nobody knows what kind of perception a sea turtle has about electromagnets, right?
It's hard to ask.
Yeah, it's hard to ask. Ask a sea turtle. We don't even know in animals that have this ability to sense electromagnetic fields where those cells are in their body. Hmm. They're not clustered together anywhere. There is no sensory organ for it, the way like your eye is a sensory organ for sensing light. Your olfactory bulb collects information about the chemicals you're inhaling. They don't have like a limb or an attachment or an organ, right? And there's no lobe in the brain that seems to be doing it. So they're like, where are those cells? But they're reliably using that information. So those cells must be somewhere.
Well, their survival depends upon it. Maybe even if we had the same equipment, we wouldn't be able to, our brains wouldn't process the data the same way because we don't really need to know where the electromagnetic fields are to like survive.
Right. We don't need it, right? So the scientists who study this in other animals have said like either humans don't have it or it's totally ancient and we don't have a way to access it anymore because you don't need it for survival. But Sampo von Cyborg, the guy who does all these magnet implants, and there are thousands of people, by the way, who have these now. It's pretty common. One of the things he was saying with me is he was really frustrated that we didn't have kind of like body mod schools the way there are art schools and design schools and nursing schools. He kind of pictured it as a school that's sort of in between those two things, and you would get a certificate to say that you are safely able to modify somebody's body. And he was saying so many of the things that people do in the piercing world are not unlike what people do in the medical world.
This is interesting.
Isn't it cool? Right?
It's almost like the ancient separation of barbers and surgeons, which have happened.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a further split coming.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, he's like, everybody get together. Like, let's do it under one roof. One of the examples he gave me is one of the kinds of body mods he does involves putting in like a surgical post and a screw. So you put it in under the skin and the post sticks up out of your body and then you screw some jewelry onto it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a stud or a spike or something like this. He has this thing called a metal mohawk on his head where he like screws spikes onto the top of his skull. It looks really cool, right? But this idea of a transdermal post is something that is used in the medical world. For example, it's used to attach prosthetic eyes into the eye socket. It's like a post that you screw the prosthetic onto. So he's like, we're using similar technologies, and doctors have a lot of information about how to fabricate things and implant them safely and to improve the design. And why shouldn't we be working together? The reason we can't work together is because people would be afraid that working with body modification would, you know, tarnish their reputation or put their funding in danger or something. Oh, wow. Like that. So interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. It kind of reminds me of like Flaubert and like the mod that they did to the guy's leg.
Wait, what?
What are you talking about?
In Madame Bovary, there's like the town doctor and there's a guy with like a bum leg and the town doctor's like, oh, I can fix this. But then later on, the doctor from the city has to come and fix it because they actually make his leg worse. And it's a similar disparity of like legitimacy. It's like, oh, you're just the hick doctor.
Oh, I see. So, body modders as country doctor.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I should say, just because people sometimes worry, like, first of all, don't do this at home.
Yeah.
Don't just jam magnets in your hands. They are special magnets that have been encased in protective coatings and stuff like that. And also most of the biohackers don't do it themselves. They go to somebody who's a professional piercer.
Oh, cool.
Or yeah, a professional body modder who will do it for them. So they're not all just kind of like sitting down there in the basement with a screwdriver on a Saturday night.
Ooh, just boy. Like
I mean,
not,
they are sitting in the basement on a Saturday night with a screwdriver, but they're not using it to put stuff in their body.
Right.
They're it's a multi-step
like,
process.
It's just like they're not piercing their own ears.
Right.
Right.
Right. I feel like aim would be a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've definitely helped someone pierce something, but
was it with a safety pin
that's
in junior high?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we had rubbing alcohol. We had to take that piercing out not long afterward.
Oh, no.
Turned out to be a bad placement. Librette piercing.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
With a safety pin?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, it took some digging.
Ah, that word in that context.
If I can inspire that noise at least once for podcast, I feel good about this.
But going back to what you were saying around magnets and sensing the difference between like being able to sense a refrigerator or a computer, maybe that's kind of, or that's kind of an interesting distinction that they were also using for the blind man.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between man-made objects and natural objects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, I don't think, I haven't really heard any claims that anybody's been able to pick up any information from the natural world using a magnet. Whatever you would get from a magnet is like very weak and it has to be close to something. Okay, the thing that people always ask me about people who are sticking magnets in their body or RFID chips are another popular one. So RFID chip is like that little transponder chip that's in your fast track pass or the card key that gets you into work or school. Some people have them in their pets. So if the pet gets lost, somebody can scan them and figure out where they belong. So a lot of people say, why bother putting that in your body? You know, you could just have a compass on a keychain, or you could have an RFID chip on a card in your wallet, or, you know, you could just carry a magnet around if it means that much to you, right? And the thing that people said to me that really, I don't know, kind of struck me. People who had magnets for a long time, 10 years or more, some of them, said, it's being able to sense things in my environment, pick up these things in my environment, is now part of what I can do, and it's part of who I am. And if you took it away from me, I would feel bereft. It's just part of my capability now. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty interesting. The idea is that they've adapted to it. They've gotten used to it. And a lot of people are doing it, using it to do like really handy things. Like I met a guy who uses it to start his motorcycle. Lots of people who use it to open doors, to boot their computer. Yeah, right? Oh. Now you want one, right?
Well, I've always wanted to take the little chip out of my Clipper card so I could just boot my way into Muni.
Yeah, see, this is coming. I know, I say, like, I have my my work entry card is in my wallet, in my back pocket, but I'm too lazy to take it out of my back pocket anymore. I just turn around and like wave my butt in front of the door,
right? You do the shimmy.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of us are already kind of doing stuff like this. I have a cell phone in my other pocket. That's pretty cyborg device that I'm carrying around with me every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, okay, there's kind of an artificial line between how close is it to your body and how much are you using it. We have a lot of technology on or near our body that we use constantly.
Oh, sure. But the moment you get under the skin, that's where the taboo starts.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Also, keeping everything constrained to a screen is not necessarily good for our health either.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I notice you're wearing glasses.
I've got contacts,
right?
Yeah.
So those are touching your body pretty intimately, right? But
nobody
freaks out about that.
Oh, but they used to a lot.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Did people freak out about contacts?
Yeah. Well, at least my mom wouldn't let me get contacts for a really long time because she recalled someone from her hometown being rushed to the hospital because like her contact, like, I don't know, something happened. I think it was the little glass ones.
Yeah.
That you would get into issues with.
But there's probably a lot of things that people are wearing on their bodies that
now,
nobody knows. Say like, one of the big arguments that I make is that a vaccine is an augment of technology.
Totally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we have it. So that like the
LASIK eye surgery.
Right.
Yeah. My mom was actually one of the first ones to get LASIK. And for the 10 years before when she'd first heard about it, because my mom is really blind, she can't see the biggie and she couldn't read and she was getting headaches all the time and it was starting to really interfere with her life. So she saw an ophthalmologist who was very conservative about it. And his argument was always, why do you want to introduce pathology to your eye? Why do you want to cut your eye?
Interesting.
Like when you're perfectly fine not doing that. And now it's something that's included in our insurance. It's something that's taken for granted.
Yeah. When I was talking with Rob Spence, better known as Eyeborg, he's the guy who built the camera in his eye. He was like, people always freak out. Oh my God, why would you put something in your eye? Ah, right. And he says, look, there's a whole field of elective surgery that involves cutting into your body to augment it for beauty purposes. It's called cosmetic surgery, and it's perfectly normal. And nobody ever questions, like, is it okay to get bigger boobs? Is it okay to get a different nose? That's just totally acceptable. And I think you can build an even bigger argument, which is to say that it's kind of just human to want to improve yourself. And we already do it in a lot of different ways. We improve the mind through education. We improve the body through exercise. And we are an engineering building species that has totally modified our environment. And we've modified our lifespan through technologies like better nutrition and cleaner water. This may just be another thing that goes under the umbrella of self-improvement. Mm. Now, you couldn't say to a person, I'm sorry, but you can't learn. Let me back up. Let me say that actually, yes, in our social history, we've told plenty of people that they can't learn.
That's true. And we're not quite done.
Right. And we've told plenty of people that they can't have certain jobs or that they can't play certain sports because they're not the right race or gender or religion or whatever. We've said you're constrained in some way. You can't compete. Right. And every time we've been wrong. So a lot of people who are in the biohacker movement are kind of pushing on this idea of body sovereignty, this idea that it's mine, so you can change it. And saying, who can tell me what my limits are? Who can tell me what I can do with my own body? I think it's a really good argument.
Right on. I was a ROM hacker back in the day. So I'm into this kind of thing.
You were a what now?
Yeah, tell
ROM hacker,
us more about this.
Video game ROMs. You take a Super Nintendo highly compressed read-only chip and you dump it into the bare hex and then you mess with it and see what happens.
Well, what happens?
Well, eventually, if it's well-structured, you figured out how to make an entirely new program out of Super Nintendo stuff.
Whoa.
Yeah, this is how I learned to program back in the day.
So what did you make out of a Nintendo game?
Other games. Yeah, it turns out it was really easy to dump all the text, dump all the graphics, dump the sound even, and use the software instruments to make new sounds.
Ooh, that's pretty neat.
Yep, as long as it's well-formed. So, I mean, being as I'm a person who, number one, is okay with hacking because I've been doing it since I was 11, and being as I am a person who has terrible, terrible eyesight, I'm super excited. I'm very excited. Do you think that one day body modification or body biohacking might become as accepted a practice as cosmetic surgery?
My argument is we're already there. We're already doing it. We're just not acknowledging it. I think if you're wearing glasses, I think if you've got fillings, I think if you're wearing a watch, I think if you've got vaccines, I think if you're using birth control, you've already hacked your body.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah, I could see that.
So
on that note, my fellow cyborgs.
Yeah.
I think birth control is a really nice example of body hacking, actually.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I love that hack.
Yeah. Yeah. Rose Eveleth had a cool article.
And life hack, really.
About it, yeah. Yeah, right? There's a million things that you could say are examples of hacks, but is medicine a hack? Like, is taking an Advil a hack? Makes your headache goes away, that pain is a perceptual experience you're not having anymore. And then, if you want to get really ancient.
Let's go.
Meditation, prayer, are those hacks?
Total hack.
They change your experience, right? How about music? How about storytelling? All the way back to just oral storytelling, you transport yourself to another place.
Yeah, I mean, I think those hacks are a way of dealing with being human versus being animal.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're going to have memory, we're going to be able to do all this planning and strategizing that, let's just assume for the case of this argument, even though I know other arguments can be made, animals cannot, then the result is that you have all this extra stress and stuff, and then all of a sudden that threatens your life.
And we have, so humans have language, which I think a lot of people have argued is kind of like a tool for hacking consciousness. Mm-hmm. So you can tell stories and transport yourself to another place, live in another life that you're not living. And then let us not forget also psychedelic drugs. That's a pretty long-standing human tradition of changing your consciousness. So I don't think this is something that is just a product of our modern technological age. I think this is something humans have been doing for as long as we're humans.
Right. And language, I mean, just like your point earlier around when we introduce a new technology, how are we potentially disenfranchising a population? Mm-hmm. Language very much works that way, right? Hmm. If you don't speak another language, then you can't participate. If you have dementia and you slowly lose words, then people assume so much more of your capability is lost than it may be.
Yeah. Oh, man. Language is it's a whole nother awesome category of weird perceptual stuff, but there's great debates going on in vision research, taste research, emotion research about whether you can experience something if you don't have a word for it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is really wild, right? And I won't go into it here because I know this podcast can't last a week. Probably not.
I eventually have to close the can of worms.
Yeah, exactly. You again, did it again. don't close the can of worms because they're going to be worms.
There's still worms.
But, okay. No, so the very first chapter of my book is about can you taste a taste if you don't have a word for it? There's a cool like search going on right now for a sixth taste, something beyond sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. Right. And the question is it right there and we're all missing it because we don't have a word for it? Like the idea of like, if there was a new color, could you see it?
Mm.
And in the world of emotion, it's can you experience an emotion if you don't have a word for it? I read a great article on this topic where they said like, I'm trying to remember, like somebody in Norway, a Scandinavian country, they have a specific word for that feeling of coming home after a long vacation and seeing your house for the first time, that feeling of nostalgia and relief. So the idea is like, can you experience that feeling if you don't already know the word for it? Or do you have to have grown up in a country that has that word?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's probably having all the other words that prevent you from the sense. Mm. Because we have like red, yellow, orange, etc. If we saw another color after we've already established that those are the primitives, then we just remix those words we already have to characterize the new color.
Mm, exactly.
Off air, let's talk about magenta, because magenta is fascinating. we should get to the rappy-uppy part of this, but I want to ask the rappy-uppy questions, which are very important.
Rappy-uppy.
You published this book late last year?
Yeah. Well, I didn't publish it. Whatever.
It was published.
People make books, publish it.
You caused it to be published.
Yeah.
What are you doing now?
So right now I am teaching. I teach at UC Berkeley. So it's the middle of fall. So we are all typing as fast as we can. Mm-hmm. That is what we are doing. And I'm doing some freelance work. I did a bunch of projects for KQED, which is the NPR station here this summer. My very favorite one was I got to go see a 103-year-old woman use virtual reality.
What?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, because there is a company that's doing VR for the elderly, which is a cool idea.
That's kick-ass.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's
last
a nice
one.
Use of VR.
Last one. If people want to know more about you and your work, what did they do? Where did they go?
Okay, so my name, which is weird, is Kara Platoni. It's K-A-R-A-P-L-A-T-O-N-I. Excuse me. Wow, I can't even say it. My name, which is weird, is Kara Platoni. It's K-A-R-A-P-L-A-T-O-N-I. And so that's my Twitter handle, Kara Platoni, and I'm also at karaplatoni.com. And the book is everywhere. It's Amazon, Kindle, your local independent bookstore. There's a really cool website called IndieBound. If you want to look up a local bookstore in your area, an independent bookstore in your area that might have it, it's all over the place.
I recommend that everyone listening to this come to San Francisco, walk up Columbus, go to City Lights Books, where I know for a fact they have it.
They have it.
And it's close to our office, so you can come have some pizza. Have some pizza.
They're awesome.
Or whiskey.
Or whiskey. We also have whiskey. And on that note, I'm going to get some whiskey. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.